content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the September 2nd, 2016 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's big campaign shakeup. What happened? Donald Trump tried to revive his faltering presidential campaign this week by replacing his controversy-tainted campaign manager, dropping his pledge to deport all illegal immigrants, and adopting a more conciliatory tone, with aggregate polls showing Hillary Clinton ahead by about 6 points nationally and by larger margins in several swing states. The Republican nominee backed away from his pledge to deport all 11.5 million undocumented immigrants and said he would follow existing law and deport only violent criminals. He also said he was softening his immigration stance for those who were working hard and raising families. "We're not going to hurt people," he said. Trump also expressed his regret for causing people personal pain with his previous comments, and at rallies implored black voters to abandon Clinton and back him. "You live in poverty. Your schools are no good. You have no jobs," he said. "What the hell do you have to lose?" Trump's shift in tone and rhetoric came at the urging of his new campaign manager, pollster Kellyanne Conway. She replaced Paul Manafort, who was ousted last week amid a growing furor over his previous work for the Moscow-based, backed former Ukrainian president Viktor Yanukovych. One report identified cash payments of $12.7 million from Yanukovych to Manafort. Another alleged that the political operative secretly steered $2.2 million to Washington lobbying firms on behalf of Yanukovych's government, a possible breach of lobbying disclosure laws. In addition to Conway, the Republican nominee also brought in Stephen Bannon, chairman of the right-wing Breitbart website, as chief executive of his campaign, and is reportedly getting advice from Roger Ailes, who recently resigned as Fox News CEO amid multiple accusations of sexual harassment. The new team is urging Trump to focus his fire on Clinton and not become embroiled in distracting name-calling feuds with his critics. What the editorial said. "Donald Trump finally appears to have jettisoned one of his least attractive positions," said the Wall Street Journal. "Mass deportation would not only be practically and financially unfeasible, it would also cause enormous human and economic disruption. The forced separation of families would rightly provoke political uproar, and the abrupt removal of millions from the workforce would probably cause a recession." Trump's critics will no doubt label his policy shift a flip-flop, but reasonable voters should see it as a sign of political progress and tolerance. "Trump's sincerity on immigration remains a very large question mark," said the Los Angeles Times. "He hasn't withdrawn his disgraceful comments describing Mexican immigrants as rapists and criminals, and he continues to push his silly idea of forcing the Mexican government to pay for a massive border wall. Did the bombastic New Yorker really have a change of heart, or did he simply realize he'd get trounced in November if he didn't stop peddling racism and nativism?" What the columnist said. "Trump's motives with this immigration shift are obvious," said Greg Sargent in WashingtonPost.com. "He desperately needs the votes of well-educated suburban whites who have been turned off by his blatant denigration of Hispanics. So Trump is assuring moderate independents that he'll target violent criminals rather than families, while telling Trumpkins at rallies he's still going to build his wall. Trump's supposed black outreach is just as phony," said Jamel Bowie in Slate.com. He isn't trying to win over black voters by telling his nearly all-white audiences it's a disaster the way African-Americans are living. With this performative empathy, Trump is merely trying to convince college-educated, right-leaning whites that he's not a racist, so it's safe to vote for him. Bannon's ascension to the top position in Trump's campaign represents the dangerous seizure of the conservative movement by the alt-right, said Ben Shapiro in WashingtonPost.com. The followers of this ugly right-wing movement, which adheres to a race-based nationalism laced with misogyny and anti-Semitism, have found a home in Bannon's Breitbart.com. Trump has flirted with the movement for months, but now he, and by extension the craven GOP establishment supporting him, has embraced it. If Trump can curb his bombast, the polls will quickly tighten up, said Victor Davis Hanson in NationalReview.com. Despite running a campaign with no serious fundraising, no national campaign organization, and myriad self-inflicted wounds, he remains within striking distance of Clinton. Her chronic lying over emails and the Clinton Foundation makes her a weak, widely disliked candidate, so Trump can pull off an upset if he can get his act together and win over undecided voters. Easier said than done, said Lucia Graves in TheGuardian.com. Trump finds it impossible not to lash out when attacked, a trait that has derailed every previous attempt to refocus his campaign. But Conway has a long list of success stories with retooling damaged Republican candidates, including Trump's running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence. Listening to women has never been Trump's strong suit, but with only 2 months until the election, following Conway's advice may be Trump's last best chance to have any shot whatsoever at winning. And a second main story. Clinton faces ethics questions over foundation. What happened? Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton was denying accusations this week that she improperly mixed public and private interest while serving as Secretary of State, amid reports that donors to her family's Clinton Foundation gained special access to the State Department during her tenure. An Associated Press analysis of schedules and emails released by the State Department revealed that at least 85 of 154 non-government individuals who met or spoke by phone with the Secretary of State also gave or pledged money to her family charity. Together, those donors contributed as much as $1.56 million, with 20 giving more than $1 million apiece. Clinton's campaign dismissed the reports as cherry-picking. This is a woman who met with over 17,000 world leaders, said Chief Strategist Joel Benenson. A new batch of emails from the private server used by Clinton while Secretary of State, made public through a lawsuit filed by conservative group Judicial Watch, showed that top Clinton aide Huma Abedin fielded a range of requests from major foundation donors, including U2 singer Bono, who asked for a live concert uplink to the International Space Station. Most of the requests led to no action. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump called for Clinton to be investigated by a special prosecutor. Former President Bill Clinton announced that if his wife is elected, he will resign from the foundation board and stop fundraising for it, and that the charity will no longer accept gifts from foreign groups or U.S. corporations. Meanwhile, the Clinton campaign faces more controversy. A federal judge has set a September 22nd deadline for the State Department to review for potential release, perhaps before the election, 14,900 previously undisclosed emails related to the FBI investigation of her private email server. What the editorial said. When she became Secretary of State in 2009, Clinton promised President Obama that she'd set up a firewall between the foundation and the State Department, said the Washington Post. She didn't keep that pledge. Foundation staffers frequently appealed to State Department staff on donors' behalf, and even though the contact often did not lead anywhere, it encouraged foreign and corporate entities to believe that their donations might pay off in access. Impressions such as these are corrosive to national institutions. The revelations in the new emails obtained by Judicial Watch are shocking even by Clinton standards, said the Boston Herald. Crown Prince Salman of Bahrain, a $32 million donor to the Clinton Global Initiative, wangled a last-minute meeting with HRC. Slim Fast tycoon S. Daniel Abraham, who has given up to $10 million to the foundation, just wanted 15 minutes of the secretary's time. No problem, even if her plane had to be kept waiting. Bill Clinton's pledge to ban corporate and foreign donations isn't enough. Nothing short of closing up shop will do. What the columnist said. There's no scandal here, said Michael Cohen in the Boston Globe. Mostly these emails show foundation donors requesting favors that were repeatedly denied. Of course, for Bill and Hillary's enemies, evidence has never been the key ingredient of a Clinton scandal. What gets lost, sadly, is the Clinton Foundation's extraordinary philanthropic work, including renegotiating the cost of HIV drugs, reducing childhood obesity, and mitigating the impact of climate change. The Clintons should have cut their ties to the foundation long ago, said Michael Tomosky in the DailyBeast.com. They had known for more than a year that Hillary was running for president and would likely win the Democratic nomination. Surely the foundation's myriad good works can be farmed out to other charities. Closing up now would nudge up her favorable numbers and de-weaponize one of the only remaining clubs Trump has to use against her. I doubt this latest bit of shadiness will hurt Clinton in November, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. People supporting her are Democratic diehards and or convinced that Trump is nuts and a danger to the Republic. In other words, she has already nailed down the segment of voters who prefer corrupt over unhinged. So no, the foundation antics won't land Clinton in jail or lose her the presidency, but it does further diminish her, making a jaded public even more cynical and governance that much harder. Our controversy of the week, Obamacare, entering a death spiral. 6 years after it was passed into law, Obamacare suffered one of its heaviest blows last week, said David Dayan in NewRepublic.com. Healthcare giant Aetna announced that it's pulling out of all but four of the state exchanges through which millions of Americans now buy their health insurance. Insurers Humana and United Health Groups made similar announcements earlier this year, meaning that in 2017, customers on about one-fourth of the exchanges will have just one or two plans to choose from. Some liberals say Aetna is acting out of spite, said Peter Sutterman in Reason.com, retaliating for the Justice Department's recent refusal to approve Aetna's merger with Humana. But even if that's true, the fact remains that Aetna and other big insurers have been losing billions each year in the Obamacare exchanges, which never attracted the millions of young, healthy customers needed to make the system fiscally viable. The Affordable Care Act may survive this near-death experience, but right now it looks like one sick patient. All of this was utterly predictable, said David Catron in Spectator.org. In fact, it was predicted. During the ACA's long, contentious passage through Congress, we conservatives repeatedly warned that in its new restrictions on insurers would lead to higher premiums, which only older, sicker customers would be willing to pay. Fewer customers would mean less revenue for the insurers, who would then have to raise premiums even higher, triggering the very death spiral that appears to have begun. These warnings were ignored, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. The president and Democrats were too busy ramming this ill-conceived Rube Goldberg health care system through Congress without a single Republican vote. They must now be held accountable for the collapse of their ideas. Obamacare has already lowered its ambitions, said Margo Sanger Katz in NYTimes.com. When the program was created, Democrats hoped the exchanges would offer plans like those provided by employers, luring middle-class Americans into signing up. But to keep costs low and competitive, insurers on the exchanges are offering very narrow networks of doctors and hospitals with few specialists and high deductibles. That means a typical Obamacare plan looks more like Medicaid than private insurance. The long-term uninsured don't mind, but for customers accustomed to choosing their own doctors, it's a turnoff. Obamacare does have real problems, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times, but nothing that couldn't be fairly easily fixed with a bit of bipartisan cooperation. Raising subsidies, for instance, would entice more customers into the exchange. So would raising the penalties for going without insurance. Republicans, however, want the program to fail. Perhaps it's time for Democrats to bring back the public option, which was dropped during the Obamacare negotiations to appease purple state Democrats and insurers. If insurers are going to abandon the exchanges anyway, why not let the government step in? That possibility is just one of the reasons Republicans shouldn't be gloating over Obamacare's struggles, said Jim Newell in Slate.com. Another is that they offer no replacement plan that comes anywhere close to the 20 million people who've gained coverage through Obamacare, including its Medicaid expansion provision. After this presidential election, Republicans need to stop seizing on every minor setback to declare Obamacare doomed. Meanwhile, Democrats have to stop pretending everything's fine and offer some very concrete fixes, or watch their signature legislative achievement fall apart. Well, it was a good week for head starts after it was revealed that Weston Emmer, 12, was leading the get out of the vote effort at Donald Trump's campaign office in Jefferson County, Colorado. Watch for me in 2040, Emmer said. It was a good week for house calls after a new luxury Los Angeles apartment complex where units rent for up to $25,000 a month offered residents such perks as on-site Botox treatments. Wealthy people just don't want to take care of the hassles that everyday life brings, the developer explained. And it was a good week for perseverance after 80-year-old Wanda Witter, a homeless woman, won her 16-year-long battle to claim back Social Security payments and received a lump sum of $99,000. $999. They kept thinking I was crazy, Witter said. But it was a bad week for family bonding after a 15-year-old Toronto girl called 911 to report that her parents had forced her to go on vacation to a rural cabin that she didn't like. This appeared to be a case of a teenager being a teenager, said a police spokesman. It was a bad week for payment plans after the British government sent a pensioner a bill for one penny with the option of paying it in installments. It's absolutely ridiculous, said Tim Quaife, 68. It has cost him 53 pence to send the letter. And it was a bad week for satire after New York City officials removed an unflattering life-size statue of a naked Donald Trump that activists stationed in Union Square Park. NYC Parks stands firmly against any unpermitted erection in city parks, said a department spokesman, no matter how small. And speaking of Mr. Trump, once again, the briefing page has the Trump empire. Donald Trump often boasts about his tremendous wealth. How did the Republican nominee amass his fortune? How did he start out? With a big leg up from his father, Fred Trump made an estimated $300 million building rental apartment villages in New York City's outer boroughs. Donald joined the family business after graduating from business school in 1968, but almost immediately set his sights on more glamorous real estate in Manhattan. In 1971, at the age of 25, he embarked on an ambitious project to replace a crumbling hotel near Grand Central Terminal with a Grand Hyatt. His father was instrumental in the deal. He lent Trump $1 million, guaranteed $70 million in bank loans, and used his political contacts to help his son get the project built. Completed in 1980, the development made Trump millions of dollars and established him as a player in Manhattan real estate. I had to prove to the real estate community, to the press, to my father, that I could deliver the goods, he wrote in his 1987 bestseller, The Art of the Deal. What was his next project? Trump used the profits from the Grand Hyatt deal to finance Trump Tower on Fifth Avenue, the 58-floor skyscraper where he still lives and bases his organization today. But his next venture almost bankrupted him. Eager to move into the lucrative world of gambling, he opened two casinos in Atlantic City, which was vying to become the Las Vegas of the East Coast. Launched in 1984 and 1985, Trump Plaza and Trump's Castle were initially successful. But the real estate magnate overstretched his empire with the Trump Taj Mahal, a glitzy, giant $1 billion casino that siphoned off customers from the Plaza and the Castle to service the huge loan Trump had taken out to build it. The Taj needed to take in $1.4 million a day, more than any other casino in history. What happened? The Taj lost vast amounts of money, and Trump's fledgling casino empire spiraled into irreversible decline. Between 1991 and 2009, its holding company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy four times. But Trump was saved by the power of his own celebrity status, which he had built up through his books, media interviews, and calculated leaks to the New York tabloids. Whenever creditors threatened to bankrupt Trump personally, he convinced them that doing so would destroy his brand and render what remained of the casino empire completely worthless. In the end, Trump's casino venture was unmitigated failure, one that cost thousands of people their jobs and left dozens of small businesses without payment for their work in building or servicing the casinos. But Trump still extracted millions of dollars by awarding himself millions in salary and bonus payments. I made a lot of money in Atlantic City, he said last year, and I'm very proud of it. What about his real estate? Those adventures have been much more successful. His major building projects include Trump World Tower in Midtown Manhattan and Trump Tower in Chicago, the fourth tallest building in the U.S. But after his failure in Atlantic City, banks became increasingly reluctant to lend him money. So Trump began focusing on monetizing his personal brand. Rather than building his own hotels and housing, Trump began licensing out his name to other developers. There are now Trump Towers and Trump Plazas everywhere, including Florida, Vancouver, Panama, and Istanbul. But Trump actually owns few of them. What else has he put his name to? As his biographer, Michael D'Antonio, put it, almost anything that might be sold as high quality, high cost, and high class. Some of these ventures, such as the Donald J. Trump signature collection of shirts and ties, which are made abroad, have been moderately successful. But many more, among them Trump Steaks, Trump Magazine, and Trump Vodka, sank without a trace. Other high-profile failures include the now-defunct Trump University, which is being sued by thousands of former students for fraud, and Trump Airlines, which lasted only 3 years. But Trump has enjoyed considerable success at one market, high-end golf courses. Since 1997, he has bought or developed 17 courses around the world in locations including New Jersey, Scotland, and Ireland. How much is Trump worth? Bloomberg.com estimates his current fortune at $3 billion. Forbes puts it at $4.5 billion. Trump himself claims he is worth $10 billion, though he has admitted that his figure goes up and down with the markets and with attitudes and with feelings, even my own feelings. His repeated refusal to release his tax returns has prompted speculation that he is worth much less than he claims, and that he takes advantage of property tax law to report an income of zero, a trick he used to pay no income tax for several years in the 1970s and 1980s. His companies are also carrying at least $650 million in debt, some of it to the Bank of China. But Trump insists his net worth cannot be separated from the unique value of his personal brand. It takes brains to make millions, Trump said. It takes Trump to make billions. We'll take a look at the columns now. First one from the U.S. Will Zika become a new STD? Will Zika become the millennials' STD? Asked Kelly McBride Folkers. The mosquito-borne virus has reached the U.S. mainland, with a new cluster reported in Miami Beach last week, and my generation in particular should be concerned. Zika can also be transmitted by oral, vaginal, and anal sex, meaning it can continue to infect people after the mosquitoes are killed or go away for the winter. Both men and women who contract Zika can be unknowingly infectious for months, even if they get no fever, rash, or other symptoms. This is alarming news for everyone of childbearing age, since Zika can cause microcephaly and other serious birth defects. Preliminary research from Zika hot zones, such as Colombia, suggests sexual transmission is likely to be a significant contributor to the Zika virus spread. Some of my friends who are planning to have children in coming years are rightly getting nervous. The federal government should do everything in its power to stop Zika now, from developing a vaccine to introducing genetically modified mosquitoes that can greatly reduce their population. For young people, Zika is not some tropical infection that matters only abroad. It may become an STD that any of us could catch. From Canada, the band that made us a nation. Canada has said a tearful goodbye to the rock band that embodied our national identity, said Mia Pearson. Gord Downie, the 52-year-old lead singer of the Tragically Hip, has terminal brain cancer, and last week he played his final concert with the group in Kingston, Ontario. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was in the audience, and the gig was broadcast live across Canada. We wept as a nation. Why did the Hip resonate so deeply with Canadians? It's because they are so quintessentially, undeniably Canadian. They're a blues rock band with two guys named Gord, who over their 32-year career have amassed a catalog of hits that evoke uniquely Canadian memories, imagery, and shared stories. In Ontario, nearly everyone can play 6 degrees of Hip Separation with our own story of how we waitressed with a band member's sister or ran into a member at a bar. Part of their iconic status comes from the fact that they never quite caught on with our American neighbors to the south. The Hip appeared on Saturday Night Live in 1995, and the U.S. just didn't get them. Their weirdness, their earnestness, their soulfulness. If our favorite band leaves us confident in only one thing, it's that what makes us Canadian is not simply our un-Americanness. And this is from Brazil, how they see us. Lochte's big Olympic lie. In falsely smearing Brazil's reputation, Ryan Lochte has destroyed his own, said Globo.com. The American gold medal swimmer claimed last week that he and three teammates were robbed at gunpoint by thugs dressed as cops after a night out partying during the Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Brazilians immediately doubted the story because our criminals never forget to take their victims' cell phones and fancy watches. Sure enough, police soon revealed that far from being innocent victims, the Americans were in fact the criminals. Security camera footage and witness testimony showed that the inebriated swimmers had stopped at a gas station in the early hours, then vandalized a bathroom and urinated on the floor. After arguing with security guards, the athletes agreed to hand over cash to cover the damage. Hardly a robbery. Lochte flew home before police completed their investigation. His sidekicks were questioned by authorities, and one, James Fagan, paid a fine of nearly $11,000 before being allowed to leave the country. Rio was Lochte's chance to erase the bad boy image he earned during a 2013 reality TV show in which he came across as a dim-witted party animal. Instead, he proved to the world that he really is a dumb jock. Blame puritanical America for this mess, said Olo de Franca Belém in Journal Opco from Brazil. Police believe the athletes lied about the robbery because they didn't want their girlfriends to know they'd been out partying late with Brazilian women. Any Latin American or European would know that lying about an assault is far more indecent than a sexual escapade. So perhaps Lochte and his friends really are victims, not of Brazilian crime, but of America's social conservatism, which makes a sin of tiny issues like sexual betrayals. In another typically American maneuver, Lochte has turned to spin to save himself, said Correo. He hired the same PR firm that worked with the singer Justin Bieber, and they dressed him soberly, tidied up his hair, and sent him on TV. He admitted that he over-exaggerated what happened at the gas station, but absurdly maintained that he had been assaulted because security guards had pointed their guns as they demanded compensation. Lochte's lie has inflamed the tempers of Brazilians, said Zarquilo Barbosa in Jornal da Cidade. We love to moan about our corruption and disorganization. After all, our president and most of our lawmakers are under investigation. But we hate outsiders criticizing us. In preparation for the Olympics, we cleaned the house, hid the clutter in closets, swept dirt under the carpet, and now the gringo comes here and badmouths us. The U.S. media demonized Rio in their reports on the supposed mugging, said Roy Castro. But when the truth was exposed, they failed to call Lochte a thug, runaway coward, and liar. We'll have to console ourselves with the knowledge that this debacle has cost Lochte at least $1 million in endorsement money. Sponsors including Speedo and Ralph Lauren have rightly dropped the disgraced athlete. And now the last word. In Venezuela, life on the line. Food shortages force Venezuelans to wait in line for hours each day for a chance to buy basic necessities, said journalist Hannah Dreyer. Many still go home empty-handed. The people waiting for hours in front of the Caracas drugstore were dazed with heat and boredom when the gunmen arrived. The robbers demanded a cell phone from a 25-year-old in black shorts. Instead of handing it over, Junior Perez took off toward the entrance to the pharmacy. Eight shots rang out, and he fell face down. The dozens of shoppers in line were unmoved. They held their places as the gunman went through Perez's pockets. They watched as thick ribbons of blood ran from the young man's head into the grooves of the tiled walkway. And when their turns came, each bought the two tubes of ration toothpaste they were allowed. These days you have to put the line above everything, said pharmacist Jaime Mendoza, who was there at the there that morning. You make sure you get what you need, and you don't feel sorry for anyone. As Venezuela's lines have grown longer and more dangerous, they have become not only the stage for everyday life, but also a backdrop to death. More than two dozen people have been killed in line in the past 12 months, including a four-year-old girl caught in gang crossfire. An 80-year-old woman was crushed to death when an orderly line of shoppers suddenly turned into a mob of looters, an increasingly common occurrence as Venezuela runs out of just about everything. The extent of the country's economic collapse can be measured in the length of the line snaking through every neighborhood. The average Venezuelan shopper spends 35 hours waiting to buy food each month. That's three times more than in 2014, according to the polling from Data Analysis. As the economy breaks down, life is telescoping to be just lines, said Data Analysis President Luis Vicente León. You have masses of people in the streets competing for scarce goods. You're inevitably going to get conflict, fights, tricks, you name it. Venezuela's vast oil wealth once fueled a bustling economy, but over years of mismanagement under a socialist government, much of the nation's production ground to a halt, and the country grew ever more dependent on imports. The supply chain broke down, first slowly, then all at once, as a steep drop in the price of oil left no money to pay for even some of the most basic necessities. Shortages now top voters' lists of concerns, surpassing even safety. That's stunning in a country with one of the world's highest homicide rates. Desperation fuels violence. Medical student Maria Sanchez looked as timid and absent as anyone else in a Caracas line for flour. But when a woman tried to cut in front of her and her mother, she was quick to throw the first punches. She didn't let up until the would-be intruder limped away. Sanchez passed the rest of the wait with her lips pressed together, her mother quietly weeping. You have to go out with your batteries fully charged or people take advantage, Sanchez said. Need has an ugly dog's face. The need is everywhere. On Wednesdays, residents of one of Caracas's wealthiest neighborhoods line up with empty 5-gallon jugs, hoping to catch a truck that comes through weekly with potable water. Poorer people wait at the foot of the green mountain that towers over the city, competing to siphon water from its springs. On Fridays, bank lines grow long because ATM limits capped at $8 daily have not kept up with the world's highest inflation, and the machines are not restocked on Saturdays or Sundays. Venezuelans now mostly avoid using cash, and even sidewalk orange juice peddlers have acquired credit card machines. On Mondays and Tuesdays, the lines outside immigration offices spill down the street as if people suddenly decided over the weekend that they could not handle one more week standing around while life passes them by. Each night, men push broken-down gas guzzlers along a river to line up at a warehouse that sells car batteries but always runs out of stock by mid-morning. All Venezuelans, including children, are assigned two shopping days a week based on their state ID number. They line up before supermarkets open, guided by rumors and where they've had luck in the past. Some use fake IDs to score extra shopping days. Pregnant women and the elderly get their own priority lines, and everyone is limited to two units of whatever is on offer. The longest lines are for what is in shortest supply, food. 9 out of 10 people say they can't buy enough to eat, according to a study by Simon Bolivar University. Prices have been driven impossibly high by scarcity, hoarding, and black market resellers. Venezuelans line up again and again for subsidized goods, not always knowing what they'll get when they finally reach the front. When supply trucks arrive, workers throw open the doors, game show style, to reveal whether shoppers will be taking home precious pantry staples or a booby prize like dog food. Sometimes the disappointment is too much to bear. Hundreds of people stormed a market in Caracas in June after the food truck they spent hours waiting for was diverted. "We're starving," they cried as shopkeepers lowered metal gates over their doors and windows. Queues thousands of people long are targets for muggers, who will sometimes work their way down person by person. Soldiers armed with tear gas and assault rifles often stand guard over supermarkets and supply trucks to maintain order. But the National Guard has killed three people and arrested hundreds this summer while trying to control nationwide food riots. A few blocks away from where Perez died in the toothpaste line, shoppers waiting to buy groceries watched a mob set a fire to an accused thief. After the man was taken away in an ambulance, some of his assailants got in line to do their shopping. Although the threat of violence hovers in the air, the line is also a place of ordinary and sometimes extraordinary life. Merlise Moreno gave birth to a baby girl this spring while waiting to buy chicken in the oven-hot plains town of El Tigre. The skinny 21-year-old suspected she might be having contractions as she applied her heavy blue eyeshadow and boarded the pre-dawn bus. Still, she said she had no choice but to go. She was out of food. She delivered her daughter with the help of a supermarket janitor and used a dusty sheet from the back room as a swaddling blanket. On hour 8 of a Caracas line for toilet paper, sweaty strangers sang nursery rhymes and cheered as they watched a 1-year-old learn to walk. Kids do homework on the curb. Some young men use the empty hours to meet women and score phone numbers. More often, though, love stories end in line. Sasha Ramos broke up with her boyfriend of 5 years amid a spat over a blocks-long line for razors. He'd spent the morning complaining that they were hardly moving, which only underlined that he never helped with the shopping. They argue and he stormed away, leaving her staring at the ground next to strangers who had heard it all. "He was so inconsiderate," Ramos said. "I'd even forgiven him for cheating." These lines are not good for love. For older shoppers, standing in the heat can be too much to bear. Irma Carrero had been staring blankly ahead for hours in a grocery line for the elderly in an upscale Caracas neighborhood this May, when her gaze suddenly became more fixed. She tilted backwards. No one broke her fall, and her head smacked the concrete. She came to and started vomiting. While most in the line stayed put, a young man volunteered to take her to the emergency room. On the taxi ride over, Carrero said she hadn't eaten since the day before. "There's no retiring from this," she said, leaning back and closing her eyes. The lines are driven by scarcity and poverty, but they also reflect how much people have given up on traditional employment. With the minimum wage at less than $15 a month and inflation running well into triple digits, it barely pays to go to work. It makes more economic sense to fill one's pantry and then sell or barter anything not vitally needed. So fields lie fallow while farmers spend their days waiting to buy imported goods. Teachers walk out of classrooms to search for food they can eat or resell. Government offices close in the early afternoon because officials need to go shopping too. "Most of these people make more money doing this than their other jobs," said David Smild, a Venezuela expert at Washington office on Latin America. "The most enterprising have turned the line itself into a business. Former housewife Maria Luz Marcano rents plastic stools and charged up cell phones, and also checks bags at an improvised line concierge stand. She makes half a month's minimum wage in a day. I'm making all this cash. I love being an independent businesswoman, she said, grinning opposite her grim-faced customers. The bleakest lines are at the Caracas morgue, overlooking the city. While the other lines are about shortages, this one stems from an excess of death. When Perez's body arrived at the morgue in mid-April, families were waiting days to collect their loved ones. The morgue handled 400 bodies that month from homicide cases alone. That's normal for Caracas, but it's more than the annual number of homicides in New York or Los Angeles. As they pass the hours outside the morgue, red-eyed relatives cover their noses with handkerchiefs to blunt the acrid stench. The cooling system has broken down and embalming chemicals have run out. Then it's off to the city cemetery. The wait to be buried there, 3 days. This was excerpted from an article that originally published by the Associated Press. Read one of the obituaries this week. The doctor who helped eradicate smallpox, Donald A. Henderson, 1928-2016. When the World Health Organization tasked American epidemiologist Donald A. Henderson with eradicating smallpox in 1967, the endeavor was seen as a medical moonshot. At the time, the Red Plague killed more than 2 million people a year in Africa, Asia, and South America, and doctors had never before succeeded in wiping out any disease. But just 13 years after handing Henderson his seemingly chaotic mission, the WHO declared that the deadly smallpox virus had been completely eradicated, one of the greatest triumphs in medical history. They did it in a time when there were no fax machines, no computers, and no cell phones, said Michael Clagg, dean of the Bloomberg School of Public Health. They did it with pencil and paper and just management techniques. Born in Lakewood, Ohio, Henderson had not yet turned 20 when, in 1947, New York City suffered a smallpox outbreak, said the Washington Post. That episode, which resulted in millions of vaccinations, spurred his interest in the disease and specifically how it might be stopped. After completing his medical training in Ohio and New York, Henderson joined the predecessor to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and rose to become head of the agency's Epidemic Intelligence Division. "I was never going to be a practicing doc," he said. "It was just too dull, really." Loaned to the WHO to fight smallpox, Henderson focused on shoe leather epidemiology, said TheAtlantic.com. Rather than trying to inoculate whole populations, he and his small team had doctors and health officials vaccinate everyone who had been in contact with smallpox patients, and then immunize everyone who had been in contact with those people. Thanks to this ring vaccination and a new freeze-dried vaccine which could withstand tropical heat, the world's last smallpox patient was diagnosed in 1977. That year, success in hand, Henderson became dean of the Johns Hopkins University School of Hygiene and Public Health, said the New York Times. He was later awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom and advised three U.S. presidents on bioterrorism. In his later years, Henderson argued that the only two known remaining smallpox samples held in secure facilities in Atlanta and Russia should be destroyed. "Smallpox was hideous and unforgettable," he said. "No disease has ever been so instantly recognized or so widely known and feared." on the Health and Science page now, a fifth force of nature. The standard model of physics holds that four fundamental forces govern the interaction of all matter in the universe: gravitation, electromagnetism, and the strong and weak nuclear forces. But physicists in Hungary have discovered a previously unknown subatomic particle that suggests the presence of a fifth force of nature, Space.com reports. Their findings may turn the standard model on its head and shed light on a range of mysterious phenomena, including dark matter and dark energy, which account for 85% of the total mass of the universe. The researchers had originally been trying to hunt down dark photons, hypothetical particles that physicists theorize may be indicators of dark matter, which is impossible to detect directly because it neither absorbs nor admits nor emits light. They didn't find dark photons, but they did discover a photophobic X boson, a strange particle that only interacts with electrons and neurons at very close range. Since it's not a mass-bearing particle and isn't governed by any of the four known forces, the researchers proposed that it could be evidence of a fifth fundamental force of nature. If true, it's revolutionary, says astrophysicist Jonathan Fing, author of a University of California at Irvine study that analyzed the Hungarian team's results. If confirmed by further experiments, this discovery of a possible fifth force would completely change our understanding of the universe. Bookworms live longer. Bibliophilia is good for your health. A new study suggests that people who read books regularly may add nearly 2 years to their lives. Researchers at Yale University examined the reading habits of 3,635 people over 50 and found that the ones who buried their noses in a book for more than 3.5 hours each week, or 30 minutes a day, were 23% less likely to die over the course of the 12-year study, reports the Christian Science Monitor. Even after variables such as health, education, and income were taken into account, bookworms were 17% less likely to die over the same period than their non-reading peers. It's unclear why reading is associated with this survival advantage, but the researchers suggest delving into novels promotes cognitive processes, such as empathy and emotional intelligence, which can boost longevity. Unfortunately, reading magazines and newspapers may not provide the same benefit. We uncovered that this effect is likely because books engage the reader's mind more, says researcher Anvi Bhavishi, providing more cognitive benefit and therefore increasing lifespan. On the Talking Points page, Louisiana floods, a disaster ignored. You may not have heard, but Louisiana is underwater, said Sean Illing in Salon.com. A biblical deluge of rain earlier this month, 24 inches in 3 days, or what Seattle gets an entire rainy season, left Baton Rouge and surrounding areas devastated by floods. At least 13 people have died, and 110,000 homes were damaged or destroyed. Many of these homes were not in floodplains, so homeowners didn't have flood insurance. It is, in short, the worst natural disaster in the U.S. since Superstorm Sandy in 2012. Yet the national media, usually so drawn to disaster porn, has for the most part remained wholly uninterested. This complaint isn't trivial, said Mike Scott in the New Orleans Times-Picayune. Relief funding for disasters tends to be commensurate with media attention. With national news coverage scarce, Louisianans are understandably worried that recovery funds will be just as scarce. There are several reasons why these floods receive so little attention, said Marshall Shepard in Forbes.com. Hurricanes with names like Sandy or Katrina or telegenic winds generally create much more media attention and public interest than torrential rainstorms. The rain hit when the Olympics and the presidential election dominated news coverage, and on a Friday night in August, when many newsrooms already understaffed because of summer vacations, were emptying out for the weekend. Unfortunately, Mother Nature doesn't work on a 9-to-5 schedule. When the media did pay attention to the flood, it focused on political theater, said Paul Krugman in the New York Times. Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump flew into affected areas for a photo op. President Obama followed suit this week after being criticized for not cutting short his vacation earlier. But the far more important issue is that these floods are exactly what climate scientists have been warning us about. No single weather event can be blamed on global warming, but higher temperatures produce more extreme weather, be it catastrophic flooding in Louisiana or drought-driven wildfires in California. Indeed, this was America's 8th once-in-every-500-years weather event over the past 15 months, said the Washington Post in an editorial. Our infrastructure and disaster response systems simply aren't equipped to deal with such extremes. The tragedy in Louisiana should serve as a warning. This is what the future will look like. And that leaves us with just enough time for a finishing quote. This is from Oscar Wilde, quoted in the New York Times. There's only one thing in the world worse than being talked about, and that is not being talked about. We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.